Yeah, let's do it. I'm pumped. Let's let the healing begin.
God help you if you use voiceover in your work, my friends. God help you. It's flaccid, sloppy writing.
I don't want you to be the guy in the PG-13 movie everyone's really hoping makes it happen. I want you to be like the guy in the rated R movie, you know? The guy you're not sure whether or not you like yet.
Hello and welcome to this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast.
Wait, you're not Brantley. Who are you?
Palmer. We are not joined by Brantley Palmer on this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. I am still, however, Lee Carlo, and this is Jeremy Fisk joining me. Today on the podcast, we are going to be discussing. We are going
so much better at this.
We need Brantley back. Today we're going to be discussing J.J. Abrams' new nostalgic slash mystery movie Super 8. We're then going to talk about this rumor that perhaps J.J. Abrams could be the next Spielberg and whether or not that theory holds water. We're going to move on into a new type of game show slash I don't know what you'd call it. We're going to try to predict what Brantley thought of Super 8. We're not going to let him hear what we think he thought, and then we're going to see who was closest, and one of us will be deemed the winner next week. And then to wrap everything up, in honor of the Steven Spielberg-produced Super 8, we're going to be discussing our top five scenes from Steven Spielberg's movies.
It'd be good for you to spend some time with kids who don't run around with cameras and monster makeup.
Could you close your eyes, please?
Yeah.
And action!
Freighter derailed. What the cargo was on that freighter, we don't know.
We can't tell anyone.
I know.
I understand you have concerns about our cargo.
Colonel, there isn't anything else that I should know, is there?
I can assure you the answer is no.
We've got calls from people who found local dogs, but the calls coming in aren't local.
Lucy!
It's like they all just ran away.
I've got property damage. I've got death. I've got 9 people missing now. There are things happening around here that I can't explain.
We have to find this thing.
I don't feel good about this.
Go!
I saw it. No one believes me.
I believe you.
What the hell?
All right, so Jeremy, you wrote an article this past week about kind of looking back on the memories of some of these mostly kind of Spielberg-type movies that J.J. Abrams has started to get a little bit of credit for making, or at least kind of heading in that direction. And I'm going to be writing an article to post this week kind of about the magic of movies and how they inspire us, like as in you and me as filmmakers, and, you know, just young audiences growing up and seeing movies like E.T., which, you know, may come up later, and a lot of the Spielberg movies of the 80s and Back to the Future and movies like that. So with these comparisons between J.J. Abrams and Spielberg, which we'll get into more of as well, I just want to know if you felt like Super 8 was at all magical.
Well, yeah, I mean, you could use the word magical. I would have used the word nostalgic, and I think basically Super 8 is one of those movies that's trying to pull at the heartstrings of our generation, people who were born in the 80s, people who grew up watching movies like Indiana Jones and E.T. and Back to the Future, and those sort of imaginative, magical movies. And I think it started getting there, but I think it missed. I think it missed the, if you want to call it the magic that Spielberg had in those original films. You know, it's kind of weird. I really enjoyed the chemistry between the kids in it, and that's what drove the movie for me, and that's what I wanted to see more of. And honestly, this whole thing with the alien was a distraction to the movie. It seemed out of place. It was like, okay, can we get back to these kids and their relationship? And that's what I wanted to see more of. And that almost got to that sort of nostalgic, heart-tugging moments that I remember from my childhood. But, yeah, I just couldn't get there. And it could also be the fact that I'm, you know, older now, and I just can't be childlike anymore after the horrible, horrible things I've done in my life.
Yeah, I don't think that's it, and this could turn out to be a really boring podcast, as some would expect, because we're just going to agree completely on this movie. And you're right, because I've heard that this movie was I'm trying to remember the name of the critic that said it, but I can't. But he said something along the lines of that this is nothing we hadn't seen before. And my first reaction to that was, well, it's kind of supposed to be like this nostalgic piece, and it's supposed to harken back to the stuff we have seen before. But at the same time, this kind of became like, and I'm going to create a term, a modern nostalgia piece. And by that I mean, like, it was trying to be nostalgic, but it had everything that we see in the modern day with monster movies and CGI and explosions and stuff that gets today's audience in the theater.
Yeah, well, I don't know what critic that was either, but my guess is when he's saying it's nothing we hadn't seen before, I don't think he's referencing the nostalgia. I think he's referencing War of the Worlds and Cloverfield
yeah,
and stuff
exactly.
like that. That's District 9 or something like that. That's what I think he's saying. It's nothing we haven't seen before, and it's true, and it's kind of annoying. And you could, the best thing that sums this up is before, and let's count the movie in two ways: before the train incident, and then the train incident. And before the train incident, I was glued. I loved these kids, and I loved their interactions with each other, and that sort of stuff did kind of feel a little bit E.T. like and magical, and that sense of wonder that you can have as a child as they're trying to make this movie, make this zombie movie for themselves. And then the train crash, which was just ridiculous with its explosions. And I mean, how many explosions could one train crash have? It was just over the top. And then there's this alien aspect to the movie, which I knew going in, but none of the sort of structures and the strings, if you were to pull them as far as plot, made really any sense. It wasn't, it just didn't sort of mesh between these characters and what these characters were saying to each other and their interaction, and then having this huge, disastrous alien destroying the town. It just seemed out of sync for me. I don't know if you agree, but
well, yeah, I do. And it was weird with the train crash being like this huge derailment of a train that seemingly never ended with explosion after explosion. Because I thought up until pretty much the end that the extent of the train crash was part of the mystery of it. Like, why would a truck make a train crash in such like massive fashion? I thought that was part of the mystery of the whole thing.
Right.
But it's, let me ask you another question, because I think that, you know, marketing and the way this movie was advertised had a lot to do with, obviously, our expectations, but a lot to do with how we ended up feeling about this movie. Because I think if this was advertised as a War of the Worlds or a Cloverfield, we might have, I don't know, maybe even liked it better, just because we would have been surprised by, like, the nostalgia it brought on.
Right. I don't know. I don't know if I would, I don't know if my expectations would have been on those sort of nostalgia, that sort of nostalgia plane, if I thought this was a War of the Worlds or the Cloverfield type movie. I probably maybe even would have suggested not seeing it had that been the case.
Your pleasant surprise that I'd assume you'd have about the relationship between the kids and essentially that other part of the movie, would that have made you like this movie better if you didn't know that? If you weren't expecting that to be the primary aspect?
I see what you're saying, but I still, my answer is probably no, because that relationship between the kids and all that I did enjoy still didn't come to fruition the way it should have.
Right.
I think it was still, it started out strong, and it started out with some good characters and some funny characters and how they related to each other, but it never got to a place where that was the most important thing. So I don't know. I mean, you used the word mystery, and I think when we get into this discussion between Abrams and Spielberg, if there is even a discussion to be had, Abrams seems to be more on that sort of mystery front, while you used the word magical, Spielberg seemed to be more on that magical front that evoked more emotions and characters, and that's what I think this movie was missing. I wanted to see more from these kids and their relationship that worked and made sense. It got distracted. This movie just seemed to get distracted. It was like J.J. Abrams gave the smoke monster from Lost a feature debut.
Right.
I mean, that's what it kind of feels like.
You
had that monster that could just grab certain people out of nowhere and sort of disappear and kill some and leave some. It's like the smoke monster got a feature movie for himself.
But before I kind of answer my own question, there was a point in this movie where, and this may sound ridiculous, but it made sense to me at the time of when I was watching this in the movie. It was kind of the first time you got a glimpse of the monster's face. Obviously, it was very quick, and Abrams does the same thing in Cloverfield. And it looked kind of like the Cloverfield monster. And I started to think that maybe, like, the big mystery behind this movie Super 8 was that this was a prequel to Cloverfield, and, like, this is where this monster from Cloverfield came from. And then that kind of just went away. But that's kind of, like, that's how much I was trying to wrap my head around the mystery aspect of this movie. And it might be because my expectations were to see a kind of nostalgia-type movie, so much so that I wanted, every time I saw one of these kids on a bike, I wanted them to, like, all get together and, you know, fly away on them. Not literally, but, like, I was waiting for that to happen. And then every time the group of kids were together and you get the goofy kid with the fireworks and everything and kind of the way all of those kids were different in one way or another, I was just, like, waiting for the Goonies, for them to go on, like, a Goonies-type adventure. And I just wanted so badly for this to be more a kind of reincarnation of my childhood experiences at the movies, that I kind of just didn't care about the you know, war movie that was going on.
Right, and
I started imagining things like, is this a Cloverfield prequel?
We should tell people that Abrams didn't direct Cloverfield. I think he was a producer on it.
That's true, yeah. That is true.
But, he was involved with that project. I'm with you, and I think the biggest problem was it seemed disengaged from that sort of nostalgic ideology that we hoped it could be and it tried to be, and the monster movie that it ended up being. And I think we can have sort of a discussion about how that went wrong, and I can relate it back to the way they used music in this movie. We talk a lot about using music and how it can be a crutch a lot of times, and how it's sort of the symphony can sort of swell when it's trying to tell you to feel something. Right. And that happened a lot in this movie, especially at the end when I don't want to have a spoiler edition of this podcast,
right. I don't either.
But let's just say at the end, during the culmination of the sort of the two storylines coming converging, I didn't even know what I was supposed to feel at that moment.
Well, this was the problem that
swelling and it was there, and for the most part, you know, Spielberg's really good at using the music as an aid, not a crutch, and he had John Williams
do it. And he could have used it as a crutch and probably gotten away with it too.
Except for maybe Saving Private Ryan, where I think the beginning and the end with the old Matt Damon, it's a really sort of cheesy use of music in a negative way, where he was using it as a crutch. But if you look at any of the other, you know, E.T. and Indiana Jones, and the way he uses music in those films, it works so well. And in Super 8, I mean, it was like telling me to feel something that I didn't even know what I was supposed to be feeling. That's how bad it was. I didn't know if I was supposed to be feeling for the alien, or if I was supposed to be feeling for the children or the relationship with the parents. I just didn't even know at that point. And I don't think Abrams knew at that point what he was trying to do.
Well, I and this won't give anything away, but the end of this movie wanted so badly to be E.T.
Which made no sense, because
I know it didn't. And this is why. And I was on the bus back from New York today, so I had, you know, nothing to do, and I listened to our Hesher podcast.
Yeah.
And we talked to, like, annoyingly a lot about how that movie hadn't earned anything that it had going for it. And this movie tried to create an emotion for the audience towards, obviously towards the kids, which I think it succeeded in, and then also towards the alien in this movie. And it didn't earn that connection between the audience and the alien. So there,
not at all, not even close.
And it almost seemed like it didn't try to. It almost seemed like it thought it could just have a quick scene, and then people would just all like be duped into thinking they cared for something. So that leading into the end of this movie, it just didn't work. It was completely wasted and pointless.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. And, you know, Abrams has a tendency to use sort of these gimmicky but fun, I guess, instructional or, I don't know, these sort of like 50s looking like scientific videos.
Yeah,
that he uses in that he uses all the time in Lost, and he uses it here again, Super 8, and they're sort of fun. The kids discover one, and that's where this premise started to come in about attaching the audience to the alien. And I just, it wasn't enough. It wasn't close to enough.
Partly because it's on the nose exposition, and Abrams' intent on keeping everything such a mystery has proven to be the downfall of a lot of his work. You think about Lost, and if you think about Super 8 now, he spends so much time keeping you in the dark that eventually he gets to the point where he's like, oh, damn, now I have to explain what's going on, and he has no choice but to do it quickly through, you know, kind of an exposition-type, vehicle.
Yeah, I think the key word for this movie would be disappointing. I mean, not just disappointing for people our age who sort of wanted that feeling of going to a theater and experiencing, Back to the Future or Indiana Jones or something like, or an E.T. or something along those lines, but also disappointing for the newer generation of kids that I don't think really have those Spielberg-esque movies out there. I think the closest they have is Pixar. But other than that, there's no live action films that really sweep you away in the way, you know, an E.T. did or an Indiana Jones or how we, you know, what we've been talking about.
Last thing before we move on, we've obviously talked about the kids in this movie as characters, but not necessarily as the performances of these four or five child lead roles. I thought they were all really good, and they kind of had this interesting adult, they had like these adult roles, but they never lost the kid aspect of themselves, if that makes any sense.
No, it does make sense. They were all sort of more, in a way, mature than their adult counterparts.
But not even just in that, like they, you know, they're doing things like making a movie, and they're, you know, obviously, you know, this is where kind of the suspension of disbelief and maybe the magic of movies comes in. They're off kind of investigating this mystery. Mm-hmm. But kind of along the way, while they're doing all these things, you still kind of see the childish immaturity showing, like the kid at the firecrackers just wants to blow things up, you know, mm-hmm. even though they're making a movie and they're worried about production value and everything.
Yeah, the casting of these kids was really what Abrams got right in this film, I can say. It's the closest he sort of got to giving us that sort of Goonies, even though I was never a huge fan of Goonies, only because I saw it too late. But that's what he did right in this film, was with those performances. They were all really, really good, and they were, you know, like I said before, the way they related to each other, they were fun. I think, honestly, the funnest part about it, I don't know if you stayed for it, but was the movie that they ended up making. I think that was the funnest part about this film.
Yeah, I loved that. That was hilarious. And what's interesting is, and I just have to point it out, because any chance I get to point out what a bad actor Ron Eldert is, I will. When he was on screen with Elle Fanning, he should be ashamed of himself, because she just acted circles around him. And obviously she has an acting background, but Riley Griffiths, who plays Charles, who's making the movie, and Joel Courtney, who plays Joe Lamb, according to IMDb, they have zero credits prior to Super 8.
So. Yeah, the kid who played Charles was great. I mean, he stole every scene he was in.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So there was a moment in Super 8 when we started seeing the glimpses of the monster. You know, we saw a reflection of him kind of in a puddle at one point, and then you'd see a shadow and you'd see a limb here and there. Mm. And it's got me starting to think about watching Jaws and how the way that slowly but surely the shark in that movie was revealed. You'd see a fin, obviously, which represented the shark so well, and built suspense. And then finally, towards the end, when the shark comes out after, and Brody says, we're going to need a bigger boat, how impactful that was in Jaws. That never existed in Super 8, that kind of impact and that kind of suspense. And I think suspense is the key word, and that's what kind of separates Spielberg from Abrams. Obviously, you talked about, and we'll talk more about it, the magic of movies and versus the mystery of movies. But I think from a, you know, theme point of view, or at least the way the emotions are evoked, suspense is really kind of the key word there.
Yeah, we talked about Cloverfield earlier. I think that did a much better job with the monster because it never showed it really till the end.
Yeah.
But this is kind of what we mean with this movie, that Abrams didn't really know what he wanted, because it was like he was starting to try and reveal it a little bit, but then he just revealed it, but then he needed the alien or the monster to be sympathetic, so he didn't know what he wanted and where he was going with it. And it's something we're talking about. This is where it becomes a little unfair to Abrams, is because when we compare what Abrams has done to what Spielberg has done, we're talking about the best of Spielberg right now.
Yeah.
You know, we're comparing the E.T. and Jaws and having this conversation about, you know, some of our favorite movies. And Abrams, certainly because of what he's done so far, hasn't earned that reputation as the next Spielberg, in my mind. That maybe we need to give Abrams a little bit more time and a little bit more of a filmography to compare the best of Spielberg to Abrams, but
well, yeah, of course we do. And I think the argument nowadays is Abrams on his way to being the next Spielberg? Not necessarily is he already the next Spielberg. So right. it is unfair to be like, well, Jaws is so much better than Super 8. I mean, Jaws is so much better than just about every movie. So that's not really fair. But I think
it's their style and their subject matter that sort of draws the comparison, and I think that's fair enough, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we're really the two are separated is Abrams' intent on that mystery you were talking about. And if he's going to do that, fine. And he's mistaking mystery and suspense, I think. I think in his movies, he's believing that just by having a mystery, he's creating suspense, which is not necessarily the case. I think some of what Spielberg does so well is making his suspense work because you know exactly what's lurking around the corner, you know?
Well, I think, yeah, the suspense that Spielberg creates is sort of created in your own mind as an audience, whereas Abrams specifically goes out like a magician trying to hide stuff from you, and then, like you say, mistaking that as suspense. And I think that's a little bit of where the difference between these two guys falls.
I watched an interview with him about Super 8, and he talked about how, like, movies that he's always loved movies that have heart, and that's what he wanted to do with Super 8. And I guess there were points in, well, I mean, there definitely that goes are points back in Super to 8 with the kids, but he,
yeah, I mean,
he wants to make, it's like he wants to make, oh, he wants to make a certain kind of movie. And he wants to have his cake and eat it, too. He wants to make a monster movie with heart, and it's, you know, it's hard to do.
It is hard to do, but that also goes back to him just deciding, this is the moment I want heart, so let's start blasting the score right here. Yeah. You know, that's where he thinks, his head's in the right place, but he doesn't, like we talked about with Hester, he doesn't earn those moments of heart. That's where he needs to learn to do, is to earn those sentimental moments, rather than just saying, hey, we got a great composer and let's swell up the score here and then tell the audience what they're supposed to be feeling at that moment. And, you know, with Spielberg's best movies, he earns those moments, you know? I mean, that's the bottom line, I think.
Thank you.
All right. Obviously, Brantley is not here today. Sort of, I guess, his own decision as far, because I couldn't make it tomorrow, and Brantley was traveling today, so he said, why don't you guys go ahead and do the podcast? And I know he's already seen Super 8, so we're going to do a new sort of game show, because I know there's going to be more times that one of us is not able to make it onto the podcast due to work or whatever. So I guess our idea here is that we're going to try and predict what the other person has to say about the movie we watched, and whoever gets it closest wins the game. And we'll make sure that Brantley doesn't listen to this segment of the podcast so that he comes in clean with a clean slate next week.
I don't think Brantley is going to be a big fan of this movie. I think he's going to be like us. I think he's going to agree with a lot of our points, but I think he's going to be even more disappointed.
I think he's going to be disappointed, but I think he's going to love certain aspects of this film more than we did. And I think specifically he's going to really defend the parent-kid relationships in this film.
I think so.
That's going to work on a level for him.
I think that's going to be one of the things that bothers him the most. In fact, I think that he'll be more forgiving of kind of the monster aspect of the movie. I don't think he's going to be a huge fan of the movie for the same reasons we were. Like, I think he's going to find that a little bit distracting, but I think he's going to enjoy that on an entertainment level. And Brantley also has a tendency to let himself enjoy a movie a little bit more than we do, and that's probably more a slight on us than a credit to him. So I think, you know, sometimes the explosions and the firefights and the monsters work for him. I mean, he didn't absolutely slam Battle Los Angeles, so
which I didn't see. I wasn't there for that.
He didn't like it. I mean, and he recognized that it was a bad movie, but he also had some fun watching it.
If that's the case, then he's really. I think he could really let himself like this movie if he, you know, totally takes off his critic hat, I'd say.
Right, but I also think that he won't do that, and he'll recognize, as for the same reasons we did, like, this is kind of, you know, told to us that this was going to be kind of a nostalgia piece, and I think he's going to recognize that it's not and be disappointed on that front as well.
I think I'm going to try and earn some bonus points here by predicting he's going to mention the fact, I mean, this is pretty obscure, that in the video that the kids make, the chemical plant's called the Romero Chemical Plant, after George Romero, the Night of the Living Dead director, and I think that's going to make it into his review somehow.
Yeah, that's a good prediction. I noticed that as well, and I was impressed with myself not being the you know, horror genre fan, but not that was real subtle either.
And I think there's going to be other references to horror films and monster movies that he's going to really enjoy, that he's going to be talking about. Well, this was a reference to this monster movie or horror movie, and that's why and there's going to be a lot of, and that's why that worked.
Right. Well, that's why, and I think that he will catch on to a lot of, which is part of the reason I think he'll be much more entertained by the monster movie that this was. Because Brantley just is more in tune with that genre, and he's seen a lot more of those kind of movies, so he may, you know, like it better, I guess, just because of that.
All right, well, we're gonna have to replay this next week and see who came closer.
What's the pool on me up to right now? What's it up to? What is it? $300? Is that it? $300? I'm a school teacher. I teach English composition. This little town called Abley, Pennsylvania. The last 11 years, I've been at Thomas Alva Edison High School. I was a coach of the baseball team in the springtime. Back home, and I tell people what I do for a living, they think, well, now that figures. But over here, it's a big mystery. So I guess I've changed some. Sometimes I wonder if I've changed so much My wife is even going to recognize me whenever it is I get back to her.
Someone we haven't really talked about at all on this podcast is Steven Spielberg.
What?
Yeah, have you heard of him?
No.
Anyway, he's a director, producer, pretty influential filmmaker.
Hot shot, big time movie person, huh?
Yeah.
Thinks he's better than everyone else.
Yeah, well, exactly. Anyway, so we obviously he produced Super 8. We had the discussion between him and J.J. Abrams. We decided for today our top five would be top five Spielberg scenes. I am trying to, and I think I'll continue to, exclude Get Your Film Fix's top 100 films from my top fives from here on out. So I did that. Jeremy, I know you didn't. Did you have any other criteria to narrow things down?
No, I really did not. Just had to have been a Spielberg-directed movie, I guess.
Right.
That narrows it down because he produces every other film on the planet.
Yeah, that would have been tricky.
That would have been near impossible. Although it probably still would have ended up being directed
films. Pretty much the same ones.
Yeah, the same scenes because these are pretty iconic scenes. So might as well just get right into it and go with my number five scene. A movie, as we always say, I need to revisit. But there's a moment in Schindler's List where Oscar Schindler's convincing Ralph Fiennes' character of what true power is.
Yes.
So that is my number five, because that scene, just the back and forth, obviously the superb acting, the way the whole scene's crafted and the way that sort of scene has its own conclusion, makes it a great scene. And there's probably other scenes I could have picked in Schindler's List, but that's the one that sticks out for me, for somebody who hasn't seen it in almost maybe a decade.
That's a really good pick. I thought about Schindler's List, and I was going to go with the kind of ending scene when Oscar Schindler kind of breaks down. I almost called him Schindler's List. That wasn't his name.
When Mr. List.
But I like that scene because it also is kind of a metaphor for the whole movie, if you think about it, because he explains that, you know, being able to kill somebody and then not doing it, that's what real power is. And obviously, Oscar Schindler was a very powerful man. He could have done just about anything he wanted.
Right.
And what he chose to do kind of showcased that power that he had. So I like that pick.
Yeah. What you just said made me impressed with my pick.
Yeah. All right. Good. I'm glad I can affirm your list. All right, my number five is a movie. It's from a movie that I don't love, and I don't know if this scene is more a credit to Spielberg or a credit to the actor in it. It is Empire of the Sun, when Jim, played by Christian Bale, sings the Welsh lullaby "Sao Gan," kind of towards the end. Kind of climax of an unbelievable performance from Christian Bale, and you have to credit, I guess, Spielberg for getting that performance out of him. It was his first movie.
Yeah, it's interesting to bring that up. It sort of makes me think of another topic we could have discussed when it comes to Abrams and to Spielberg, and it is dealing with child actors.
Yeah.
And they seem to do that, especially Spielberg seems to get a lot of good child performances in his movies. That's a movie I thought about, but I just, with all the other great choices and me not narrowing it down, there's just no way I could have had an Empire of the Sun scene on my list.
Well, obviously excluding the Get Your Film Fix Top 100, this kind of turned my list into a bit of a off-the-beaten-path Spielberg list, which I kind of like.
Which is good, because now we won't have as many repeats.
Yeah, because it would have been the same list otherwise.
All right, my number four is a movie I think I enjoy more than most people, but it is still a highly touted movie, and maybe his last great film. It is in Minority Report, and it's a moment when Tom Cruise's character realizes that the precogs were right, and he is going to kill the man they said. It is the way that that's structured and the way that that is revealed to the audience. It's just perfect. It is really a great moment.
Yeah, something I'll never understand, and obviously that the opening arrest scene was an honorable mention for me, would have been on my list if not for it being in our top 100. But something I will never understand is, and we saw that movie together in the theater, people were walking out of that movie.
The movie didn't get enough credit that year. It should have been up for at least a best screenplay
and
or adapted screenplay.
I think it's slowly but surely coming around. I think the majority of reviews from respected critics are that it's good.
Well, the more and more the inventions are coming true, the more and more people are looking back on
that too,
as sort of a benchmark sci-fi film, and it really
it's
was.
It's a great movie. I really don't understand the negative response to it when it came out and continuously.
I don't know if it really had negative response, but it was sort of a kind of an action movie with Tom Cruise, and it is so much more than that.
It's really
a benchmark sci-fi movie that should be talked about with Blade Runner.
Yeah, I agree. I like it way more than Blade Runner. I know that I'm not a huge fan of Blade Runner, but
right.
All right, my number four is a movie that I recently learned, now that I live in the big city of New York and I spent some time near Broadway, I realized this was adapted into a musical that is currently on Broadway. It is Catch Me If You Can. And it is the scene when Frank, played by DiCaprio, cons Tom Hanks into thinking he's a CIA agent when they're standing right next to each other. Tom Hanks is trying to capture Leonardo DiCaprio. He's just explaining that they just missed him. And he hands him his wallet to prove that he's a CIA agent, and Tom Hanks simply doesn't open it.
Drop it!
Relax! You're late, all right? My name's Alan, Barry Allen, United States Secret Service. Your boy just tried to jump out the window. My partner has him in custody.
I don't know what you're talking about.
What, you think the FBI are the only ones on this guy? I mean, come on. Come on, he's dabbling in government checks here. Been following a paper trail on this guy for months now. Hey, you mind taking that gun out of my face? Please, really. I mean, it makes me nervous.
You see some credentials.
Yeah, sure. Take my whole wallet. You want my gun, too? Come over here, take my gun. Hey, look, just do me a favor. Take a look outside. Look out the window. My partner's walking into the car as we speak. Look. Old guy almost pissed in his pants when I came through the door. He jumped right through the window onto the hood of my car. Hey, Murph.
Yeah, call the LAPD again. I don't want people walking through my crime scene.
I didn't expect the Secret Service on this.
Don't worry about it. Well, what's your name?
Hanratty. Kyle Hanratty.
Mind if I see some identification?
Sure.
You know, you never can be too careful these days. Well, tough luck, Carl. 5 minutes earlier, you would have landed yourself a pretty good collar.
Sound right?
Right. There's a lot of fun scenes in that movie, and it's one of those movies that I didn't love at first, but the more I just catch it on TV, I just watch the whole movie. And
it's a lot of fun, yeah.
It's really well done. I mean, it's a really good movie, really good performances. I don't know another movie that I think should get a little more credit than it does. Number threes. Now, this is one I know would be, well, I would assume would be on your list, and that is the Normandy D-Day landing of Saving Private Ryan. It is something we never before saw on film, just a sort of visceral, emotional, interactive sort of display to the audience that we had never quite seen before. It just threw you into that moment on the beaches of Normandy that we've seen since then, and other movies have tried to copy it, video games have tried to copy that, and it's just so, that movie is just so real and so visceral and so should have won the Academy Award for Best Picture over Shakespeare in Love.
It's the only reason it's left off my list is because we praised that film enough for it to make our top 100 again. All right, my number three, perhaps my most obvious pick, but it was hard to exclude. It's the scene in E.T. towards the end when they're all running away on their bikes and the government's chasing them, and E.T. has them take off and they get away. And we talked about the way Spielberg uses music, and that's one of his best moments. And, you know, I didn't obviously have this experience, but my mom has told me that, you know, people cheered as soon as the bikes took off. Again, something you don't get in movie theaters anymore that I wish maybe happened, as much as I hate people talking in movie theaters. That's the kind of thing I feel like is missing from the...
Well, cheering and talking are two different things.
Well, yeah, obviously.
I had some really annoying kids next to me just trying to talk their way through this whole movie, and it really killed it for me.
Yeah,
I mean, that could have also, like, made me bitter towards children at that moment. So take that into account when review.
That happened. That happened to me with Bridesmaids. I had the worst audience, and it seems like every other time I see a movie, I have a bad audience. But anyway, back to E.T., you know, I didn't experience that rush of emotion in the theater with you know, people who were able to see that film in the theater. But, you know, I still recognize that as kind of a very memorable scene, I guess is a good way to put it. It's magical, and it's very well put together. And it's structured perfectly into the story, too.
When's the last time you saw E.T.? Because I have to see that movie.
Yeah, you know, it's been a couple of years, but it actually has been recently enough for me to, you know, recognize that movie as a really good one and kind of remember all the themes that run through it and kind of how I saw it when I knew enough about movies to understand it as a good movie.
All right, my number two. Jeez. It's a famous scene, almost for its behind the scenes aspect of it as for the scene itself. It's in Indiana Jones. It's when there's a sword wielding guy and looking all intimidating, and then Indiana Jones just shoots him.
Yeah, I thought about that scene.
Yeah, and it's just as famous for the fact that Harrison Ford was sick that day, and he's like, you know what, I can't do this. Because I guess there was a big stunt fight that was choreographed, and he's like, I can't do that, why don't I just shoot him? And they're like, yeah, I think that's a good idea, and it just works. It's such a fun
scene.
Yeah,
it's brilliant. Yeah, definitely thought about an honorable mention for me. All right, my number two is from Munich. And we talked a little bit about Spielberg's ability to create suspense. Munich has some of his best work in that department.
Yeah.
And it's when they're about to blow up an apartment to kill one of their targets, and the target's daughter answers the phone, I think when they're expecting him to. I don't remember this movie exactly to remember exactly how the rest of that scene plays out, but I do remember the looks on their faces when the girl answers the phone and they don't know what they're supposed to do at that point. And it's really this kind of perfect suspense.
That's the scene that sticks out for me in that movie, if I had to pick one. I said Minority Report was his last great movie. Maybe Munich is.
Munich was my favorite movie of that year, whatever year that was. I'm obviously well prepared.
After having revisited Munich, it's a really well-made film, as you would expect it to be. All right, my number one, and
I know what it is.
You already know what it is. The world knows what it is. It is the SS Indianapolis conversation on the boat during Jaws.
What happened? Japanese submarine slammed two torpedoes into our side, Chief. He was coming back from the island of Tinian Delady, just delivered the bomb, the Hiroshima bomb. 700 men went into the water. Vessel went down in 12 minutes. Didn't see the first shark for about half an hour. Tiger, 13-footer. You know that when you're in the water, Chief? You tell by looking from the dorsal to the tail. Well, we didn't know. Which our bomb mission had been so secret. No distress signal had been sent. They didn't even list as overdue for a week. Very first light, Chief. Sharks come cruising. So we formed ourselves into tight groups. You know, it's kind of like old squares in a battle, like you see in a calendar, like the Battle of Waterloo. And the idea was, shark comes the nearest man, that man, he start pounding and hollering and screaming. Sometimes the shark go away. Sometimes he wouldn't go away. Sometimes that shark, he looks right into you. Right into your eyes. You know the thing about a shark? He's got lifeless eyes. Black eyes, like a doll's eyes. When he comes at you, he doesn't seem to be living until he bites you. And those black eyes roll over white, and then... Oh, then you hear that terrible high-pitched screaming. The ocean turns red, and despite all the pounding and the hollering, they all come in and they rip you to pieces.
I mean, there's just... This is what... This is exactly what Abrams was missing in Super 8. The ability to sit down characters, let them engage with each other, let them have a conversation. We all know how their personalities they're at that point and how they interact with each other. And just the way that that scene unfolds, and then to top it all off with John Williams' music and the shark coming back in. I mean, that it's a near perfect scene. It's near perfect if you're a director and you want to learn about the best way to create suspense. It's near perfect if you're a screenwriter. It's near perfect if you're an actor with what Robert Shaw does in that
scene. I mean, it's so much about that scene. I mean, it is probably one of the greatest Oscar snubs in history. Robert Shaw not even getting nominated, I don't think, for his performance as Quint. The fact that that scene was not in the original script, which kind of goes to show some discipline from Spielberg as still such a young director. He recognized that this movie needed something, and they put that scene together. And then I guess that Robert Shaw showed up really, really drunk the first time they were going to do it and embarrassed himself, and then they did it again the next night, and what we see is kind of a combination of the two.
Really? I didn't know that.
So, I mean, all of that just kind of brings together, and yeah. It's such an amazing scene it is. It's kind of incredible.
Like I said, there, it's just lay. I mean, it's everything about it is near perfect. It's really a scene that should and will be studied for years and years to come.
Yeah, and I've heard that people, and you know, they don't say this as necessarily a knock on the scene or the movie, but they point out that, like, that scene is just there. But that scene kind of, that's basically Quint's background all in one scene. You learn so much about him, why he is the way he is, and it's really kind of it's structured perfectly into the movie, even though it kind of seems like just a scene on its own.
Well, it is kind of a scene on its own, but it reveals so much. It reveals where these characters have gotten to by that point. You know, obviously Quint and Richard Dreyfuss at that point are not... you know, aren't best of friends, but they sort of, you know, over a few drinks, are able to put sort of differences aside, and there's just the socioeconomic aspects to that scene.
And you have Chief Brody, who's the, you know, the police officer, essentially the closest thing maybe to military, and he doesn't know what happened on the USS Indianapolis. It shows how out of his element he is on that boat.
On water, on a boat, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on.
Masterful scene. I mean, to be honest, I had a top five put together before I realized I wanted to exclude Gary from the top 100, and it was, of course, my number one. But in place of that, my number one, more on the suspense front, it is from Jurassic Park, a movie that I like more and more every time I see it, and it is the first scene in which the T-Rex is revealed. The footsteps have the glasses of water shaking in the car. And everything about that scene, it's a perfect reveal of the looming danger that goes on throughout the movie. And Spielberg just knows how to use everything around his scene to kind of create suspense and entertain you. Like I said, the glasses of water shaking, and then you see where the goat was hanging, and it's all of a sudden gone. It had been there all day. And then you finally see the T-Rex's head come up, and almost without realizing it, he knocks down the electric wires. And until then, you kind of forgot that, oh yeah, there's no power.
It's an honorable mention. It was my number five, but I had to kick it out for that Schindler's List moment. Yeah, I mean, it's exactly what Abrams fails to do, I guess, in this in Super 8. And part of the reason he fails to do it, like we said, is he just didn't know where he wanted to go. Imagine in Jurassic Park if you reveal the T-Rex like that, but then by the end you try to make the T-Rex your friend. It's just too messed up. It's not going to work. I mean, stick with one thing or another. And you're right. Just the way he reveals it, with the goat being gone, the ripples in the, how iconic is that image? The ripples in the water, in the
you
glass.
You see it everywhere. Every highlighted, you know, every time you see a highlight clip of movies from that studio or from Spielberg, you see that image. And it's funny because Jurassic Park is not going to go down in the history books for great movies. Although I think it's very good. But it's great filmmaking.
Okay, well, that is going to wrap it up here on the Get Your Film Fix podcast. Next week, we will be joined back again by Brantley. Hopefully, we'll be talking about Terrence Malick's Cannes, the Palme d'Or winner for Best Picture, Tree of Life.
Finally, Tree of Life.
Yes, we've been wanting to review. This is my most anticipated movie of the year. We'll see if it stacks up to that. Also, we want to encourage everyone to go on over to getyourfilmfix.com, check out our articles, check out our past podcasts, the web series we got going on up there. Also, if you could, rate us on iTunes. It makes a huge difference. Just give us a star rating on iTunes and write a review. And also, we want to encourage everyone to check out the Exterior Films podcast, and they have a new podcast up talking about comic book movies. So that's going to do it. Thanks a lot.
I'm staying. I'm finishing my coffee. Enjoying my coffee.
Apparently so much better at that.
Yeah. This is the first one that he hasn't done.
Yeah. I'll do the intro so we each have a shot at it.
What did I do wrong?
Nothing. I just want to do the intro.